Thanks. So yeah, today we'll be talking about Postgres query planning. That's kind of the process of going from SQL to like actually something that the database can execute. This talk will come in two parts. First, we'll talk about some fundamentals. We'll talk about some theory. We'll talk about relational algebra, which is kind of the theoretical foundation relational databases use, and go over some basic ideas for optimization of queries. And then in the second part, we'll actually look at how Postgres does it. We'll look at some actual Postgres query plans, kind of how to read them, and just how the planner works, at least in concept. OK, so part one, relational algebra. This sounds a bit boring, but it's kind of the theoretical foundation for this. I won't go super in deep, but there's definitely some useful concepts in there. If there's anyone in the audience who's like really into relational algebra, you'll probably be a bit disappointed by some of the simplifications I'll make. So yeah, bear with me. So for our examples, we'll just start with a simple example database with two tables. We have one table called customer. There's just two rows in there for two different people, and a second table called orders, where there's also just a few example rows in here. The data types and all of that don't really matter too much, like kind of the implied ones work. We're more interested in kind of talking about some of the more higher level concepts. So the first operator from relational algebra we'll look at is the projection. The symbol for use for the projection is the uppercase pi. It looks kind of funky in some fonts, like kind of like a square thing, and some it looks more like similar to the lowercase pi. And that projection corresponds to the select part of an SQL query. So if we start with our table and apply the projection, that would look like that. We give the arguments kind of in the subscript of the operator. In this case, it's just the names of the rows, the names of the columns we're interested in. Up here we start with all three columns, ID, name, and registration date, and we filter it down to just ID and name. Makes sense. The second operator we'll look at is the selection. The sign used for that is the lowercase sigma. And here's where something kind of unfortunate has happened. The selection does not correspond to the select part. We've already covered it. It corresponds to the where part. I blame the SQL people for this. I think the relational algebra people came up with the name selection first. Bear with me. This is a bit confusing, I know, but I hope it's the only like really confusing name thing in this presentation. And yeah, what the selection does, it corresponds to the where part, so it filters rows based on a condition. And we, again, write it down in a very similar way. We just write down the condition in the subscript of the operator. So here we can see the query on the left, and that corresponds to what we see on the right. We are filtering down to only the rows where the registration date is greater than the 1st of August 2021. And we just end up with one of the two customers. Right. The last operator we'll look at is the join operator. Specifically, we'll look at like not the usual join used in relational algebra, but the theta join. That is the join with like an explicit join condition. I think that's a bit easier to understand. It's the more general one. Again, it works in a similar way. It, of course, corresponds to the join part of the query. That makes sense again. And here in the query, we have select name, product ID, order time from customer, join orders on customer ID equals orders.customer ID. And this last little bit here, of course, is our join condition after the on. And yeah, if we join two tables, then that looks kind of like this in relational algebra. We just, again, write the condition in the subscript in the arguments of the join operator. And here we just end up, as we can see, there's just like the customer ID 1 in the specific orders we have, which corresponds to Eventropia. So we just end up with those two rows. Keep in mind, we also have a selection here. A SQL selection which corresponds to a projection. I didn't write down all the columns over here. So that's also something going on, just to keep it a bit simpler on the slides. OK, so far we've just looked at like single parts of queries. Now let's look at entire queries and kind of how to represent them in relational algebra. The way to do that is as expression trees that look kind of like this. So again, we have a query you already saw, select name from customer, where registration date greater than 1st of August 2021. And these trees, we kind of read them from, well, data flows from bottom to top. So we start with all of the rows from the customer table, then we do the selection, and then we do the projection. And the root of the tree at the very top, that's always where we kind of get our final result of the query. And the general order for these nodes over here on the right is we start with the tables, then we do the joins, then we do a selection if we have it, and then we do the projection. And that's kind of the, I'll also refer to it, it's like kind of the naive order that will always work, that will always kind of give you the correct result. Okay, let's look at some tricks we can do here. And let's look at a first rule we can kind of derive from relational algebra, that is splitting up projection. So if we start with a table R with the columns A, B, and C, if we do a projection down to the column A of the table R, that is the same as doing a projection down to the column A of the projection of the columns A and B of the table R. Sounds a bit confusing, but basically what we're saying is we can throw away some columns earlier if we want to. So again, visualized with the tables over here, if we start with the columns A, B, and C, do a projection down to just A and B, and then do a projection down to just A, of course, we just end up with column A. But we can just skip this step in the middle. We can just project down to column A right away. But we can also add in this extra step of dropping one column and then dropping the other column. Or we can just drop all of the columns we don't want at one time. So yeah, ends up being the same result. And there's an optimization we can do with this in mind. This is the same query again. All the customers with registration date greater than 1st of August 2021. But the query tree at the right has slightly changed. We have this extra projection in here. So what we're doing is we're starting with all three columns of the customer table down here, ID, name, and registration date. And then we're dropping ID, because we aren't actually interested in it in any part of our query. Then we're doing the selection, and then we're projecting down to name. OK, so why is this useful? Why would we want to do this? The idea behind this is to reduce the size of like the intermediary sets we need to deal with in like while processing our query. So of course, if we kind of like have all, like right now we just have three columns, a lot easier. But if we have lots and lots of columns, if we need to carry them around with us in every step of the way, kind of, and just throw them away at the very end if we don't need them, of course, it's more efficient to not carry them around with us if we don't actually need them. That means we use less space and like buffers between the different steps, and it potentially means faster processing as well. Okay, so that's the first optimization we can kind of make. Don't carry around columns we don't actually need. Oh. And what we do need to do is we can't just project down to name down here right away, though, because we do still need the registration date to actually be able to apply our selection up here. So selections or like join conditions, stuff like that, is something you do need to keep in mind with this optimization. OK, let's look at a bit more complex query and kind of get used a bit more to the representation as a tree. And the first part of the query we've kind of already seen earlier, select name, product ID, order time from customer, join orders on customer.id equals orders.customerid. But now we're also adding a selection. Now we're also filtering the result. We're filtering where name equals Eventropia and order time greater than 1st of August 2021. And then at the right, again, we have kind of the naive order we've kind of talked about earlier. We start with the tables, then we do the join, then we do the selection, and then we do the projection. OK, let's look at another rule that we can use to kind of play around with our queries. So if we have a selection that contains an AND, that's the like roof thing we can see here, that's a logical AND. If we have a selection that joins two conditions with an AND, that is the same as applying the selection with the first condition to the result of the selection with the second condition, or the other way around. Like, the order here doesn't matter. So kind of our takeaway here is conditions joined by AND can be split up into actually like two or even more separate selections that we can run after each other on the results of the previous selection. And the order doesn't matter for AND. So let's see what we can do with that. Here we have the same tree again, but we've actually split up the selection. So instead of having one selection with the condition name equals Eventropia and order time greater than 1st of August 2021, 2022, whatever, we now have two different selection nodes. And of course, if we kind of think about this again, only rows with name equal to Eventropia will end up here, and only rows with order time greater than 1st of August will end up here. But of course, because we've already thrown away everything that doesn't have Eventropia, this will only have rows that like satisfy both conditions up here. OK, so far, this hasn't really helped, right? Like, we've just made our tree a bit more complicated. But if we take another look at that, we can see, or if we remember kind of the table layout from earlier, each of the selections only apply to a single table, or columns from a single table. So the name column is comes from the customer table, and the order time column comes from the orders table. So one of the things we can do now, actually, is move around where in our query tree we're doing those selections. So we've just moved down this selection based on the name to right after the customer table, and we've moved the order time right behind the orders table. So kind of what we've changed here is we don't actually need to join up every single customer that has ever existed with every single order that we ever had and end up with a potentially gigantic set that we then just like filter down again. We can filter down first and then do the join. Of course, that's a lot less data we need to carry around, a lot less complexity, or a lot less work in the following nodes, and a lot less work in the join node, of course, because there's just less rows to deal with. And as we'll see later, that has kind of something to do with indices as well. Doing this, like having conditions just right after the table, that helps the database even more because, for example, it can use indices, stuff like that. We'll talk about that later. OK, so that's the second optimization we can do. Try to apply selections as early as we can to, again, reduce the size of the data that we need to deal with, that we need to move around between different stages of our query. OK, let's look at a, again, slightly more complex join. We're joining a third table product. I haven't really mentioned that at first, but we can kind of imagine it exists. And we can like join the orders.product ID on like the ID column of the product. Kind of makes sense. And this is one way to do it. We can first join customer and orders, and then join the result of that to product, and then do the projection. We could do it the other way around, right? We could also first join product and orders, and then do the second join, just kind of move it up there. It doesn't really matter. We can do both. Both orders work, give it the same result. But I mean, which one's better, right? So suddenly we have choices to make, which is kind of annoying. So because the order, like which order is better, depends on a lot of things, actually. Which is more efficient depends on like the sizes of the tables. If one of the tables is really tiny, then probably joining that first might make sense. So we end up with like smaller set sizes. But of course, it also depends on like the conditions we have, because like if we push down one of the conditions, that changes the sizes of the set we're dealing with again. And of course, like the result of like if we're applying a condition, how many rows we end up with, that depends on the data in the table, which is kind of annoying. And it gets even worse. Like there's different join implementations to join implementations to choose from. So we can do like a nested loop join or a hash join, stuff like that. We need to pick which one's the best. We might be able to use indices as well. They might have us, they might not. There's just a lot of decisions to make. Okay, so where are we? There's a few optimizations that pretty much always make sense, like pushing down selections, like filtering down as early as possible, or projecting early. Because that pretty much always decreases the set sizes we're dealing with. That's pretty much always beneficial. But there's some other choices where it's a bit harder to say which one's better. And like simple rules as like always push down selections as fast as we can aren't enough. But what we've looked at still is useful in that context as well, because the rules from relational algebra and kind of what we can derive from it is a good basis for correctness. So kind of the worst thing that could happen, the worst thing we could do, is like change around stuff in a query, and then we end up with an incorrect result. Like that wouldn't be good. If we get like a different result than the naive plan, then we've done something wrong. And just kind of looking at how relational algebra works, what it tells us, is a good start for thinking about like the things and the changes we can do in a query plan and the changes that we can't that will mess up our result. Okay, short breather. I'll take a sip of water before we go into the second part. Okay, let's actually open the hood. Let's look inside. The most useful tool for that is explain. So if you give Postgres explain and then like a select query, what does that does is it asks the database for a query plan for this query. It doesn't actually execute the query if you just do it in explain. So it's pretty quick, and it's a super useful tool for figuring out what the database wants to do. And these explain trees, like they're also like a tree structure similar to what we've seen in relational algebra. They do look a bit different, the specific nodes we're dealing with, but I hope still kind of some of it transfers, and of course the ideas are the same. Usually explain gives like a text output, which is kind of hard to read, at least on slides. And there's also the option to do JSON output, and there's a few tools to visualize the results of an explain query, so that's what I'll be using in this talk. Okay, let's take a bit closer look at the table product we've seen earlier. So each product has an ID, and there's a second column called number of foos, and each product has like 0, 1, 2, or 3 foos, whatever that might be. Okay, and now we can do a query where we are just interested in the products that have 0 foos. Okay, so let's see how the query plan for that looks. So there's just one node here, which is a bit surprising if you've seen what we've done earlier with like the selection, the projection, the tables, all of that. It's just all in one node here. It's called sequential scan or sexgen scan, or also sometimes known as like a table scan, and it basically just does that. It just goes through all the rows in the table one by one and applies the condition and then just spits out the results. If we open up this node and look at a bit more of the details, like there's a short description of what this node kind of does, and we can get some more details if we look into these tabs down here. So for example, in the MISC tab, we can see the filter, which is product.numberofFoos equals 0, which is that corresponds to the selection we've seen earlier. If we look in the output, that gives us the names of the columns that will actually come out of this node. That kind of corresponds to the projection. So it's all just kind of bunched in together in one node. In this case, that's kind of how Postgres does it. But again, if we have multiple nodes in a query, the rules from relational algebra to how we can move around the selection terms and the projection and stuff like that still apply. They're still the same. OK, and if we go back into the general tab, there's something interesting in here as well. It says rows, and then it says not available. And that's because we haven't actually executed the query. And if we had, that would show us the actual number of rows. And then it says planned 24,623. It's interesting. How does it know, right? We didn't execute the query, right? We just asked the database for the query plan, and it said how many rows we were going to get. The answer to that is statistics. Postgres collects statistics either when you explicitly ask it to, by using the analyze command. You can give it a table and it will go through and collect statistics for the table, or it will also do it automatically during the auto vacuum process, which like periodically runs in the background. And there's one statistic type, there's a few different statistic types, but there's one we're interested for this, which is the most common values statistic. And we can actually just ask the database about the statistics it has from a specific table by querying the kind of special pgstats table, or its view actually. And we can ask it for a few different things. We can give it the table we're interested in, and then the at name that corresponds to like the column that we want the statistics for. And again, we want to know the statistics for number of foos in this case. And the result of this query looks like this. So what does this mean? The first thing here, the null frac, is how many rows had the kind of special value null in this column, in the column number of foos. We get zero here because none of our columns, none of our rows have the value zero here. We have n distinct, that's how many different distinct values the analyzer saw in this column, and that's four. It's kind of to be expected, as I said earlier, each product has a number of foo equal to 0, 1, 2, or 3. So that's four different values. That's what we see here. And then the next two are kind of the more interesting ones. That is the most common values and then the most common frequencies. These curly braces, they look kind of funky, and they're just the array notation Postgres uses. So the first one's an array with four integers, and the second one's an array with a bunch of floats. And here, the first one, the first entry in this array corresponds to like the first entry in the second array. So if we write it down in a bit easier to read way and we round the numbers, basically what this says is the number 0 appears 25% of the time in 25% of the rows, number 1, number 2, and the number 3. So each of them are like 1/4 of the products. Okay, so that's kind of cool. So how does it work? If we query for equality, Postgres can check the most common values, and it can see whether the value we're querying for is actually one of the most common values. And if it is, it can just like read from the statistics which fraction of rows that will hit. But even if the value is not one of the most common values, that tells us something, because then we know the value is uncommon. And the frequencies of the most common values kind of give us an upper bound to how many rows this query might still match. Okay, that's all good, but like, is it actually right? We can check that by using explain analyze. And what? Oops. Oh, that was bad. Oh, that was even worse. Just lost my speaker view. That's unfortunate. sorry about that. Where's my speaker view? Ah, there's my speaker view. Shouldn't see that. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, we're back. Is it right? We can find that out by using explain analyze. So that kind of does the same thing as explain. It gets us the query plan, but it also actually executes the query. It doesn't give you the query results, which sometimes is a bit unfortunate, especially for queries that do take a long time. But yeah, what it also does is it collects a bit more statistics while actually running the query. So if we open up this node again, it's the same sequential scan, but we have some more data in here. So for example, what we can see here is the number of rows. Now we can see the actual number of rows over here compared to the planned number of rows. That's pretty good, it's pretty close. Of course, like we're just dealing with statistics, so if these don't fully match up, that's good enough, that works. And for example, one of the other bits of information that's collected is the timing, so how long Postgres spent executing this specific node. Okay, let's play around a bit more. Let's add an index on this column by doing a create index on product. on the column number of foos. And we're still doing the same query. We're still doing select asterisk from product where number of foos equals to 0. Kind of the idea now is maybe the database can use the index to actually find those rows quicker. And if we do an explain analyze again, we see a slightly different query plan. It's actually a bit more interesting. There's one node down here called a bitmap index scan. And if we read the description here, it says it uses a bitmap index, which is one bit per page, to find all relevant pages. Okay, like, what the heck is a page, right? So, okay, for this, we need to go a bit into how Postgres actually stores data from tables. So on disk, Postgres uses something called a segment file, which is typically 1 gigabyte, which contains multiple pages. And pages are 8 kilobytes each. And each page contains the data from multiple rows. And another thing we assume is that the order is kind of random. So the page has like some header data, and then there's pointers to like the different items, which are the rows. So this might be one of the rows of our product table. This might be another. There might be a bunch more in here. OK, why do we assume random order, right? It's kind of weird. That has to do with how Postgres actually deals with updates or deletes and stuff like that. So if we were to update this row up here, what Postgres doesn't do is it doesn't just override this row in place, but it just kind of marks this one as outdated. And it writes a new version of the row that we've just like updated somewhere else. It might be in the same page, like it might be up here. It might be in a different page, wherever there's space, basically. So as we update stuff in a table, the rows just end up wherever they want, kind of, or wherever the database wants. So we can't really assume they're sorted by like primary key or any specific column. They're just kind of in some order. OK, but this tells us a bit more about like what a page is and what that might mean. So these are the two nodes we just saw, the bitmap index scan and the bitmap heap scan. And the bitmap index scan works by creating a bitmap. So that's just an area in memory with one bit per page. And the database knows how many pages there are for a specific table. And what it then does is it goes through all of the rows in the index. It's kind of a simplified way of like showing how indices work in general. Postgres uses B-trees, which look quite a bit different. But the basic idea is we have a quick way of finding all of the rows with like the value 0 as the number of foos. And for each row, we know in which page it lives. So what the bitmap index scan does, it just goes through through the index, applies the condition, and then just collects which rows we need to look at, which rows those which pages those rows are in. And then what the bitmap hits, the bitmap heap scan does, it is receives that bitmap and then just goes through all of the pages that are returned by the bitmap index scan. But it doesn't know where in the page the row is, right? It just knows there's one, maybe more rows that match the condition in this page. So it just goes through the entire page and filters based on something called the recheck condition. So if we look at the plan again, what we can see, oh no, I hit the wrong thing again. Oh no, where did it go this time? I'm sorry. Okay. Hang on. Okay, there we go. I'm sorry. That's kind of a weird setup I have here. OK, sorry, we're back. So this is the same query plan, the explain analyze plan we're looking at. And here again, we can see the bitmap index scan that kind of goes through the index and creates this bitmap of which pages we need to look at. And here in MISC, we can again see the actual condition it's checking the index for. And yeah, some other information, for example, again, gathered from the statistics, how many rows this is going to match. And then again, as we saw in the relational algebra part, the data kind of flows from bottom to top. And the result from the bitmap index scan goes into the bitmap heap scan, which then goes through the actual pages. And then based on the retag condition we can see here, go through all of the rows in each of the matched pages and actually picks out the rows we're interested in. OK, it's kind of cool. We're interested in a higher number of foos. So now we want all of the rows that have a number of foos greater than 0. So that would be 1, 2, or 3. Let's look at the query plan for that. And we would probably expect it to look kind of similar, right? We just expect it to go through the index again and all that. We're back at a sequential scan. OK, cool. Like, why would it do that? The answer to that is something called cost. You might have seen it in the plan nodes. I haven't really talked about what it means. So if we go back to the sequential scan we got, we can see in here, if we open it up, Postgres has estimated a cost of 1,790 for this node. There's not like really any specific unit for this, just kind of made up. But lower cost is better, and higher cost is worse. Okay. And one thing we can do now is we can actually do a bit of a trick and say to Postgres, please don't do a sequential scan. We can force it to not use a sequential scan and do the index scan again instead. And if we look in here, again, we have like costs, cost for the bitmap index scan. It's 830. Sounds pretty good, right? But if we then look up here, we can see the cost for this single node. And then the total combines like the cost of all of the nodes under this specific node. So it just gathers the cost up for like the entire part of the plan, or just the entire query in this case. And we can see the total number of costs we see here, 2,330. That's like a lot bigger than what we saw for the sequential scan. So that's kind of interesting. So why would it think the sequential scan is cheaper to do than the index scan? For that, we need to kind of look at how the cost calculation is actually done. The first thing the planner does for that is determine the number of pages of the table we're interested in. That's a piece of data it just has. And also the number of rows. That's also something it like at least vaguely knows. And then the total cost for a sequential scan is the number of pages multiplied by the sec page cost, plus the number of rows multiplied by something called the CPU tuple cost. And so the first part of this equation kind of models the cost of I/O we need to do. We need to like actually read these pages from storage to go through them. And then the second part is kind of the cost of like picking out the single rows from the page and just kind of like at least moving them around, looking at them. And this is kind of interesting, like having both of these in here, the pages and the number of rows. But of course, depending on how much data is in each row, a different amount of rows fits into each page. And if all of the rows just have loads and loads of data, you might just fit a few in a page. And if all of them just have very little data, a lot of them might fit into a page. But yeah, it's kind of interesting to have both of these parts in here. And the sequential page cost is like a cost factor that is applied to sequential page access. So just starting at the start of a segment file and just going through all of the pages in the segment file and just going through all of the rows in the pages. And then the second, the CPU tuple cost, again, is like the time factor, the cost factor for processing one row, one tuple. And both of these are actually user configurable, so you can set them to different values. And maybe you should. But we'll talk about that a bit later. So the cost calculation for the index scan, or like the bitmap index scan, that's a lot more complicated, unfortunately. So we won't really see like a nice equation for that. But the important difference is it involves something called the random page cost. And that is the cost for just going to a specific page and reading that page. And that is typically set higher to the sequential page cost. The idea behind that is seeking around in a file and jumping to different offsets, that is less performant than just going through the whole file, at least like per access. And that's especially true for like hard drives. So kind of the idea behind why it does the sequential scan is, OK, it knows we're hitting 75% of all rows because we want number of foos greater than zero. And each of those numbers is like 1/4 of the rows. And it kind of decides, OK, reading like almost all pages in like but jumping around, like that is going to be slower than just reading through all of the pages sequentially. That's kind of the idea behind why it chooses the different plan here. But as I said, there's a lot of assumptions in these cost factors. As I've mentioned, they kind of apply for hard drives, but especially if you're using flash storage, the difference between doing a sequential read of like lots and lots of pages in a segment file isn't as big as doing just a random access to a single page. And these cost factors are definitely not accurate. For example, if your entire database fits in RAM, if you can cache the whole thing, because then the difference between a random access and sequential access is basically zero. So depending on which hardware you're using, tuning might improve your performance quite a bit because the query planner is able to make better decisions. And I don't know if anyone of you was attentive enough, but if you look at the actual numbers for the timing of the two different queries, you can see that actually on my machine as well, actually doing the index scan would have been the faster way, even though Postgres opts for the sequential scan. OK, let's kind of go through how the planner generally works again. So kind of the first step and the kind of the biggest thing for actually making decisions is it retrieves the statistics for the table and for the columns we're interested in. And what it does then is explores different plans. It has a lot of things to like play around with. It can use a sequential scan, or it can use an index scan, or a bitmap index scan. That's what we saw earlier. It can do different join orders. That's what I mentioned at the very beginning. It might use different join implementations. And which one it might be able to use is maybe also based on like which indices are available. And there's actually also one other trick that we haven't seen at all. Postgres is able to actually parallelize parts of the query, so spawn multiple processes, let them process part of the results, and then combine the results of them. And then for each of these plans it's exploring, it estimates the costs and also like the number of rows per node. And the cost might be, for example, for nodes that take an input, it might be based on the number of input rows. It might also be based on the statistics. And of course, it also uses those user configurable cost factors. And I've just talked about two, but there's loads and loads more for tuning different parts, different costs of different operations. And then it chooses the plan with the lowest cost, which hopefully is also the fastest or uses the least memory or in other aspects is the best one, for example, in terms of I/O. But of course, it's not perfect. There's a few limitations. So statistics are only that. They're only statistics. And usually, they're pretty good. But of course, if you have very big data sets, there might be like some edge cases where the estimate isn't as good. And that might kind of lead the query planner down the wrong way. And of course, also, the more complex your query gets, we just saw some very, very simple queries here. The more different query plans the planner actually can consider, the more different join orders you have, the more different combinations of like join orders and index scan versus sequential scan. There's just a lot of things to look at. And the problem here is we do have to be pretty quick with query planning, because if we have a query that's pretty fast anyways, like even if we do the naive way, then spending loads and loads of time trying around different orders and different stuff isn't really worth it. It actually adds latency to our query. And there's a few common pitfalls I've definitely run into when doing this sort of thing. So one of the things we've already kind of seen in this talk is the arguments you provide to a query can change the plan quite a bit. So if we do something like number of foos greater than zero, like, OK, that's going to give us a different plan than, for example, if we were to do number of foos greater than three, because there's no number of foos greater than three, so that's probably going to figure out that it can do a different query plan there. And sometimes, of course, these arguments like come from stuff users input or like different IDs people can click on and stuff like that. So just looking at one plan for like one specific case might not give you the full story. And if you just change something slightly, it might kind of go over the edge and choose a different plan for that. The other thing I've definitely run into is it's kind of tempting to add a limit, especially if you do explain analyze on a really slow query. But that does change your query plan, because the database knows, OK, if you're just interested in the first 100 rows, there's probably a quicker way to do that. It doesn't have to join everything together. There might be an easier way to just combine the data to just give you some of it, if it doesn't have to actually give you all of it. So adding a limit is not too useful for debugging. It can sometimes help, but it can also really lead you down the wrong way. And the third thing, which again, kind of complicated, but I think good to know, one thing the planner does is it assumes your columns, or the data in your columns, is statistically independent. What does that mean? There's a simple example for that. For example, if we have a table with cars, and say we have 10% with brand equal to Ford, and 1% with model equal to Focus. But I mean, all of those model Focus are going to be Fords, right? There's no other car maker out there that makes model Focus, I think. I hope so. But if we're doing a query where we're saying brand equal to Ford and model equal to Focus, what the planner is going to do is it will assume those two things are independent of each other. And what it will do is it will just multiply those fractions with each other to estimate how many rows will be matched. And what we'll do is 10% times 1% will just give us 0.1%. But of course, the actual number is 1%, right? As we've seen up here. If we assume all of the things with model equal to focus are going to be Ford, then 1% of the data will be matched by this query. So one way to work around this is there's actually a possibility to do multivariate statistics, where it looks at like data combinations from different columns and actually kind of tries to factor this in. That helps a bit. But the other thing to also consider, I don't want to be rude here, but stuff like that indicates that maybe your schema isn't great, and maybe you should like split it out into like a different table that actually combines model and brand, and you don't like maybe you shouldn't store that in the same table. But yeah. And kind of what I want to leave you off with is a bit of a step-by-step recipe for what to do when you have a slow query and you kind of want to figure out what the issue is. So the most important tool, again, is explain analyze. And one thing that's really interesting to look for in there is big mismatches between the estimated number of rows and the actual number of rows. Because that tells you, oh, the planner has gone down like a weird road here. It has misestimated something. And that often leads to bad query plans. And another thing to kind of look for is like, OK, is it not like using indices you should be using, you think it should be using? Is there maybe something like wrong? Is there some index missing? Something like that. Is there some index you could maybe add to speed things up? Stuff like that. Then the next level up is to actually turn off certain planning nodes. That's something I talked about earlier, just telling the planner, don't ever do a sequential scan. That's really good for like playing around and then like looking at the costs for the plan where you turned off certain nodes and the default plan. And that might give you a hint to why it might be not picking that plan and why it's thinking it has a, like, then you need to kind of go down like to figure out why it thinks that plan has a higher cost, even though it might be faster. But the important thing is like, please don't ever do this in prod. Turning off certain nodes is pretty much bound to mess up your query in some cases, or some parts of your query. Again, like the query plan you end up with and the query plan that's best depends on input, potentially. So this is kind of dangerous. It's good for playing around. It's not good for like a permanent solution. And the last thing is tuning those configurable cost factors, checking whether they kind of match the hardware you have. But it's something to also kind of be careful around and maybe go step by step. But there's because there's like kind of cases where some queries might benefit from some change, but there's also other queries where it might not be better actually. And if you set it like wildly wrong for your hardware, of course you'll end up with query plans that just aren't great. Okay, and at the end there's a list of a few other things you can look at if you want to go a bit more in depth. There's a really good chapter in the Postgres documentation about this, which goes a bit more into different statistic types and kind of how to read these query plans. There's also a chapter on like all of these tunable cost factors. There's a bit more information about the multi-version concurrency control. That's like the moving around the rows in the pages. That's what I mentioned earlier, kind of on the side. And the last thing is the plan visualizer used in these slides, which I would recommend using something like that instead of trying to go through the text queries, text-based representation. I think, especially for complex queries, it's a lot easier to find your way around in something like that. Thanks. Any questions? Sorry.
No, you ask.
Please just pass the mic on.
So, is there no way to actually tell Postgres, please dump all the options you have considered for this query?
Unfortunately not.
That would make it a bit easier.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
And that is unfortunately one of the limitations of using Explain. Like, it only tells you which query plane it chose. It doesn't show you the other ones it like looked at and didn't choose, which would make debugging stuff like this a lot easier. I don't know if it's something where like people have looked into trying to patch that in. I've not seen anything.
All the statistics you can see in the plan and the timing and stuff, is this done in the background by Postgres or only when you explain something? So can I fetch it in monitoring or is this done when you do explain?
Usually it's only done when you do an explain analyze, but I think there's options to actually turn on logging this, like at least for slow queries. I think you can like set a threshold to if you have like a query takes more than, I don't know, 1 second, then it should dump the query plan somewhere. I think there's an option like that.
Oh, that would be useful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No worries.
Thanks for the great talk, been amazing. you actually talked a lot about the software side of things. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, because you mentioned, okay, there's obviously a huge difference in between HDD and flash mm-hmm. storage. Whether you gathered some experience on those, because we actually have seen, though we are operating MariaDB, so still there's huge differences between different flash storage devices, especially regarding f-sync problematics.
Unfortunately, I don't really have much experience on that, but yeah, that's another thing that like gets kind of sticky with like how the database like actually makes sure stuff is written to storage. Don't really have much insight on that, unfortunately. Sorry.
Thanks anyways, though.
No worries.
Two questions. One is, which kind of tool do you use to visualize it?
Oh.
Is it somewhere to
For the queries?
Yeah, exactly.
Ah, yeah, that's this one down here, PEV2.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
And the other question is, you mentioned that tables are basically used and then they are structured in the with the pages and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But how is it used for subqueries where you already have a result?
Mm-hmm.
How is that done? I mean, there are basically pages, I assume.
Well, there's a lot of different ways. So actually, the conceptual way is like for subqueries, like, okay, you just have like a completely separate query within your query, but the query planner is actually like able to optimize around that. Like, it might be able to just like actually push a condition you have like in your outer query up into your subquery, if that's faster. So subqueries are more a concept that's like useful for structuring queries and not necessarily too interesting for the query planner. Because it like kind of assumes they don't exist and it just kind of treats it as a box, but it's able to still move stuff in and out of the box, kind of. But yeah, of course, if there are cases where like it does need to buffer the result of like a part of a query, whether it's a subplan or just some usual query node, and it's able to, like there's different limits again you can set, it's able to spill that onto disk if it doesn't want to fit that into RAM. I don't 100% know how, like, which storage model is used for that. I think it's not using pages, though, because some of the limitations to like why it's doing the stuff with pages comes again from the multi-version concurrency control. It doesn't need to do that for like intermediate results from queries. Yeah.
Hi. Do database implementations have a look at the file system that they are running on, and do they consider them, like difference between X4 and Butterfs and whatever?
That's a good question. I can only talk about Postgres here. Not really. I think there's some options you can only set on certain file systems. Like for example, for like the fsync stuff someone has mentioned, I think there's some file systems that have some optimizations there that you can use if you're using that file system. But in general, it's more up to you to actually set these factors correctly. And Postgres doesn't really do much in terms of like looking at the actual hardware and trying to figure it out itself. Yeah.
Or if you've like got a query that's being executed a lot of times a day, or like a lot of times even in an hour, does Postgres ever cache the query plan that it generates?
Oh, that's a good question.
Like it's probably difficult to do because the data could change, and like it needs to reanalyze every time it does it. But
yeah, that's a good question. I think it might do that to a certain degree, and I think there's some mechanism where you can actually like specifically ask it to, like say, like give it a query and say, like, yeah, okay, I want to execute this query more often. I think one of the other upsides of that would be if you have a query that is quite long. Of course, like you need to transfer the whole query to the database each time if you run it a lot, and you can kind of like get around some of that network latency also with that. But yeah, I don't really know about like much of the details of like when it might do caching and what it might cache. But of course, like, yeah, the statistics might change, but they don't get updated like every time the table changes. They only get updated when the auto vacuum comes along, and that might be fairly often in tables where there's a lot of activity, but of course it's like not like for every query or something. Yeah.
Do you think that the current Postgres defaults for costs and everything are still accurate for today? Because, I mean, it's quite old software. Have they changed a lot over the years, or are they fairly conservative on that part?
I don't actually, like, I haven't looked at the changelog for, like, the default values. I don't think they've changed a lot. I maybe some of them aren't great for current hardware. Like, there's also some that apply to, like, CPU cost of different things and different operations. But again, I think it's just hard to find good defaults there, because it does depend a lot on like the specific, like the CPU costs might depend on like the actual like kind of CPU you're using, stuff like that. I think there's just a lot of variables involved. So yeah.
Since it depends so much on the hardware that you actually are using, are there any, I would say, recommended ways of finding out good thing? Like, is there a program I can run that just simulate, that I can run for like a day that just does things and at the end says these are good values for you? Or is it
so I have to say I'm not super into the operational side of that, so I don't actually know. Like, there's some web tools I know where you can just kind of like give it the number of CPUs you have, which kind of storage and all of that, and that gives you some recommendations, and that's probably a good starting point. But yeah, I don't know of any tool that like actually does benchmarking on the hardware, but that would like feels like it would make sense. So yeah, I don't know.
Is there a way to form Postgres of any correlation in your data?
Well, I mean, kind of. Like multivariate statistics is one way to kind of do it. The other way is to, choose a different table layout, basically. So, for example, if, instead of, again, if we're with our cars example, if we have a separate table that just, like, has, like, maybe an ID column and then, like, links to, like, another table with all of the different manufacturers and then another table with all of the different models and just, like, kind of links those two up, the planner, like the statistics for that table will be a lot like simpler to work with, because it doesn't need to consider whether two rows are correlated, whether two columns are correlated, and that generally will give you better query plans.
But there's no way to have any custom input or give it hints from me, the database owner, who knows what my users usually input.
I don't think there's like a manual way to like hint it that these might be highly correlated, other than like actually just adding statistics for it and letting it figure that out itself. But yeah, your mileage may vary on that as well. Yeah.
Are there any other questions? No one?
Yeah, not a very quick question, but maybe I can chip in regarding the performance or default settings. So in general, Postgres tried, my knowledge might be a little bit outdated, but to be very much on the conservative side. So basically, the default settings which you typically have are for very, let's say, restrictive hardware, so like you're still using or assuming that you have an HDD, having not that much memory and so on. So it might definitely be worthwhile to check that. And something which you might try is using PGBench. So in general, it depends on, of course, also what kind of data you expect and what kind of queries, but that could be a starting point if you want to manually inspect it.
And again, like there's even stuff that like doesn't affect how the planner works, but like limits for how much it will like put like cache intermediate results into RAM or when it will start to spill over into like durable storage. And those are pretty low, like by default. So if you have a lot of RAM, increase those values.
Any further questions? Then I'd like to thank you for speaking here at the GPN again.
Thank you.